Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, live from downtown Jersey City and the great state of New Jersey. It's a pleasure to be back. I was out last week. Thanks very much to Alan from Six Degrees for guest hosting last week for a show about Rancho Mastatal, a sustainability education center in Costa Rica. If you missed that interview, you can go back in the archives at WFMU.org and take a listen. So tonight, September 2nd, 2024 is the final show of the summer season, and I'm happy to announce that the show will continue in the next season, which starts next week and goes through, I think the beginning of June 2025. And so I'm on the schedule, and it's going to be at the same time, Mondays at 6 p.m. Eastern. So thanks to everyone who has been a listener for a day, a week, a month, or all of these years. And maybe I'll say a little more about that when we kick off the next season next week. But I wanted to let you know that I will be back next week at the same time. And I wanted to finish out this this summer season with a fascinating interview. This is a book interview. The book is called The Afterlife of Data, and I'm going to be speaking with Carl Oman, who is a professor at Uppsala University in Sweden. And yes, I think there is, for longtime WFMU listeners, I think there is a connection between Uppsala University in Sweden and Uppsala College, from which WFMU emerged. So there is that connection. But we're not talking about Uppsala in this interview. We're talking about, as the book's subtitle has it, what happens to your information when you die and why you should care. It's published by University of Chicago Press. And what we're going to be talking about is the fact that human civilization has always memorialized our deceased relatives, friends, community members in some way. And the way we memorialize them is by keeping around some kind of information about them. For example, one common way that people still memorialize the dead with information is by chiseling into granite or marble or whatever it is and putting a gravestone in the cemetery. Here lies, here's the name, birth year, year of death, that sort of thing. Maybe an epitaph. That's information. And what Carl Oman is pointing out is that the information that we are storing as a society is increasingly not chiseled granite, although those still exist, but not paper so much anymore, not paper records, printed records. It's all digital increasingly. And the digital information comes with certain affordances and some downsides, which we're going to get into. But suffice to say, for the moment, a lot of things are going to change in how we conceive of our departed friends and relatives, and on a larger scale, how we conceive of our own history is going to change now that our information is turning digital. And I'll let it out a little bit here. The information is mostly owned by five companies. So we're going to get into all that. But let me play this interview for you. And if we have time afterwards, I have a really interesting deep cut from one of those five companies about what they plan to do with your data. And it's pretty hair-raising. But first, we have to learn from Carl Oman, set some context by hearing about the afterlife of data. If you want to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments. And if you're listening in the future to an archive or podcast version, again, this is the September 2nd, 2024 show. And you can go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and click the playlist link there to get all that information. Let's go ahead and listen to my interview with Carl Oman now here on Tectonic on WFMU. Carl Oman, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks.
Carl, your book, The Afterlife of Data, is concerned with what you call the challenges that arise from our post-mortal condition. I thought that was an interesting phrase. Can you say what you mean by the post-mortal condition?
Yes. So, like, the pitch of the book is pretty simple, really. Whatever you do on the internet, it's going to leave some kind of trace behind. And when you die, all of those traces on hundreds of servers across the world are still going to be there, which means that someone's going to have to ask the question, what do I do with all these data? Now, that can be a practically challenging question of, like, how do you find it, let alone getting access to it? Who owns it? But it's also a morally challenging question. So what should I do with these data? Should they be preserved for maybe your kids, grandkids to look at, and so on? Now, I'm asking that type of ethical questions, but not only what should happen to one person's data when they die, but rather an entire generation. So I'm looking at this as a collective matter. In the next three decades alone, about 2.2 billion people will die. So we as a society are going to have to ask, what do we do with the first generation of internet users who are now still present online, but they're dead? And so the argument with a post-mortal condition is basically saying that the conditions of being dead have fundamentally changed. But they are nevertheless conditions. Like, we're free. We're free to choose what we do with the dead, but the conditions of that choice have fundamentally changed in the digital age.
Yeah, you write quite a bit about how the dead have been memorialized and remembered and recorded in past eras, even back to ancient civilizations. You write that human beings are and always have been in constant correspondence with their past. In a chapter called From Bones to Bytes, B-Y-T-E-S, you explore how the dead were remembered in the ancient past. There's a quote from Lewis Mumford, a tech critic I bring up occasionally on the show, who points out that the dead were the first to have a permanent dwelling. So here we're getting a little history of how the dead were treated before the onset of digital data. And it's interesting. The dead, as Mumford said, had a permanent dwelling at a time when humans were more nomadic.
Yeah, I mean, so this is part of the greater narrative of the book, bringing up these very large historical narrative. Because whenever people hear about the theme of the book, the dead on the internet, it almost seems like an oxymoron. They're like, oh, that's such a quirky detail of the internet that there are also dead people on it. And my reason for doing this very long-term narrative, going back to our nomadic origins, is that I want to turn things fundamentally around in saying that, no, actually, we are the newcomers to the internet, because the internet is one big archive, and the archives were built for the dead. So we are now moving into a depository of the past, and that move of the living joining the dead in a structure that was originally built for them is very similar to the move from Paleolithic to Neolithic, when these nomadic tribes first settled down in the only permanent structures that they have, which are sepulchers. So people literally settle down, stop being nomads, to settle down within the dwellings of the living. In a very literal sense, they would live in the graves. They would, you know, they would keep their dead kin underneath their floors. I bring up with this one particular community, the Natufians, who would even separate the head, and they would keep the cranium, like an adorned cranium, upstairs, and then the bodies would be kept downstairs. So they'd literally be surrounding themselves with the adorned skulls of their ancestors. And my argument in this chapter that you're referring to is this is the original Facebook and kind of what Facebook is becoming.
Of course, you're being a little cheeky here, but you also point out that by, I think it was the year 2070, the number of accounts for dead users on Facebook might outnumber the accounts for living users.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a quite plausible scenario. A friend of mine who I did my PhD with, who's a data scientist, we did the study together during our PhDs, and we got hold of incredibly good data, very detailed data on demographics on Facebook, such that we could actually split in every country. We could see the number of users within each age group. And then we could match that with mortality projections for the United Nations. So we could actually predict like how many Facebook users will die in each age group in each country over the course of the 21st century. And of course, it became like a catchy headline in the media of the dead outnumbering the living on Facebook. But it's like, it's a very real thing. It's a very real problem. I don't know why people still tend to think about the internet as some new flashy thing that is here for the young and the immortal, in a sense, when I'm like, well, you know, the first internet users are actually starting to die. And my generation, I was born in the 90s, sure, like we have a long way ahead of us, hopefully, but still so in the next couple of decades, the statistics are very clear. There are going to be hundreds of millions of dead social media users, and there's virtually no plan for what to do with all these data.
And you said you were born in the 1990s?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So a bunch of us listeners just got a reminder of our own mortality. Well, there's an irony that's central to this book, which you argue very persuasively, that on the one hand, we're living in this internet, which is one giant archive. And as you have just told us, archives historically have been dedicated to the past, to the dead, to history. And at the same time, we're in this hypermodernity, which is totally uninterested in talking about death. You write at one point, modernity is intrinsically hostile to the dead. So How do we resolve this tension, Carl, if we're living in a society in a time that doesn't want to talk about death, and yet we're also living in a giant archive that is filled with more and more data from dead people?
That's actually part of the title of the book is kind of play with the concept of postmodernism. So there's a famous book called The Postmodern Condition, and I'm calling my book The Postmortal Condition. And it's a book, actually, this is a parenthesis, but it's also a book about technology originally and how technology kind of breaks modernity apart. But my argument is that modernity is so predicated on how the dead lack legitimacy. They lack political legitimacy, ethical, social legitimacy. So throughout modernity, the dead become increasingly hidden from public view. If you go back like 150, 170 years, death would have been a kind of public event almost. When a person was dying, you would gather the entire village and they would come join you and say their last goodbyes. Your family would be around you at the moment of death, and you would call for a priest, and the priest, who would be some kind of spiritual expert, so to speak, would relieve you into the spirit world. Whereas during modernity, death becomes a solitary event. We die not in our homes, but in hospitals, surrounded not by spiritual experts, but by medical experts. And death is increasingly hidden from public view. It would be absurd to be like, this person is dying, let's gather the village and go see them. Most people today haven't even seen a dead body, let alone seeing somebody die. Enter now the internet. And everything changes all of a sudden. The dead are all around us all the time. They're in our phones, on our laptops, in our social networks. And from the beginning of social media, we see a fundamental shift in how people speak about grief and how people share their thoughts of the dead. It's really interesting, not only how people talk about their own grief and relationship to the dead, but also how they continue using their social media profiles as kind of platforms for communication. And people actually post stuff on dead people's profiles as if they could read it. So it's common. There's a study on this. I think it's something like 40% directly addresses the dead person in saying, like, I know that you can read this. There are even comments to the effect of, oh, I'm so sorry I missed your birthday yesterday. We were up in the mountain hiking and we didn't have service, so I'm writing you today. As if, like, just thinking about the dead cannot transcend the border between the material world and the spirit world. So everything changes as soon as social media emerges, which seems kind of quirky to us when we talk about it. But as we zoom out, it becomes apparent that this happens every time there's a new revolutionary technology. Like when we started building stuff out of stone, kind of like we talked about, the first thing we build with stones are sepultures. And then with written language, writing becomes immediately, intimately connected to communication with the dead. In ancient Egypt, for instance, it was a common practice to leave notes and letters at the tombs of the dead because it was thought that the dead could read, but they couldn't hear what you're saying. If we fast forward a couple of centuries, even a millennia, to photography, it's the same thing. First thing that people photograph, corpses. Then with the telegraph, that hundreds of thousands of people, in particular in the United States, were using the telegraph to communicate with departed spirits. And, like, you know, it's absurd to us now that, like, why would the telegraph be able to transcend the other side, so to speak? But for them, it was access to something that was completely absurd. The fact that you could talk to a person who was hundreds of miles away, to them, it was magic. And it's kind of the same with the internet. We tend to speak about it as if it's this ephemeral space, like beyond the material realm, and that the stuff that we put there will be there forever in some kind of digital heaven, which we know is not the case, but nevertheless, that's the culture that formed around it.
So here we are in this moment of change, as the internet is still relatively new when taken in comparison to the sweep of human history. And as you say, people are relating to it as though it has some special magical or spiritual powers. It's not enough simply to think about the dead or to give a mental message to them. You have to wait until you get back to Wi-Fi to write them the note on social media. This also makes me think about, in the last year or so, we've heard about AI startups that have a connection, claim to have a connection to the dead. They're going to take all of the social media data from a deceased family member, let's say a deceased grandparent, and they're going to come up with an AI chatbot using facial photographic or video data, so it looks like you're actually conversing with a dead grandparent. How should we think? I mean, to me, that is ridiculous and more than a little creepy, but how do you think we should think about this, Carl?
I was one of the first to point to the ethical consequences of this, but I think that I've, over the course of the past 5 or 6 years, I've actually come to think of it slightly differently. So what I wrote in my first study on this, this is back in 2017, was that these kinds of services had gained some traction. Like there were a couple of startups at the time doing this. And what I brought to the table was saying that, look, this is not just about the technology. It's about economics, basically. These representations of the dead, they're not just neutral representations that arise from the data. These are designed products, and they have a very particular purpose, which is to make profit for the firm that designed the chatbots. So rather than just being any version of your grandparents or whomever you want to simulate through the AI, it's the version of them that is the most likely to keep consumers talking to it, to generate more interaction. So they become kind of like I'm drawing on Marx in this study, where Marx has this distinction between living and dead labor. And dead labor is essentially any kind of means of production. So the more a capitalist invests in means of production, it means that they need a living working force to activate that value. So if you have, you know, many factories, you need a lot of workers to actually bring value out of those factories, which means that you can buy more factories, but then you also need more and more workers. Now, this, and he calls this living and dead labor, and he shows how capital, dead labor, kind of becomes like an undead creature that just craves and craves more labor from the living. And I'm making an analogy here to the dead labor of internet users and saying that, well, if you have a lot of data from dead people and you pay for the server space to host that and maybe the AI technology to simulate it, you need living labor. You need interaction from the descendants to actually make it a worthwhile investment. So it becomes this kind of like the dead users literally become this undead agency that just craves more and more interaction in order to survive economically. Now, that was my take back then, and kind of raising the flag of like, look, these are not just any representations of the dead, but they're rather the most profitable representations of the dead. Now, what has happened since is that large language models have developed so rapidly and become accessible to virtually anyone, such that, you know, I could just go onto Facebook and copy paste a conversation that I've had with one of my friends, dump it into ChatGPT-4, and basically ask the bot to reproduce this personality based on these data, and then add some like very basic demographic data. And I will have not a perfect, but I will at least have a representation of who they were as a person. So it's no longer necessarily primarily going to be a commercially driven phenomenon, even if it's still that, but it's also going to be so much broader in the sense that everything we do could be used to be fed into an AI that reproduces our personality.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Carl Oman, author of the new book, The Afterlife of Data: What Happens to Your Information When You Die, and Why You Should Care. We're having a good conversation on the Accu Playlist live listener comment board. You can join in, or you can just read the comments if you go to WFMU.org and click the link that says Playlist and Comments. Or in the future, you can find the link on tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview with Carl Oman now, here on Tectonic on WFMU. One of the key points you're bringing up there is there's this reality we all live in the internet as it's organized today, that if we want to gain data from a past conversation or a friend or relative, whoever, we often have to go to one of the giant big tech companies,
yeah,
where those conversations are stored. And that brings up an ethical dimension, because if we want to memorialize past friends and relatives, we're not doing it for a profit motive. And yet the big tech companies are motivated only by profit, as you bring up in the book, yeah, and as I've pointed out ad nauseum over the years on this show. And that brings up an ethical quandary. Here's what you write, quote, digital data are increasingly concentrated around a handful of powerful private actors, which has led to power asymmetries of unprecedented proportions. Never before have so few had so much control over so much information about the past, and with it, the power to shape the present. Carl, what should we know about the role of big tech today in controlling the past and our present, and being a gatekeeper to these relationships we have, past and present, that are powered by love, not by profit?
Yeah. So I think there are dual dimensions here. One is what you bring up with like the private aspect of like a person in the future who want to seek their past, who wants to know like who were my parents, or what did I come from. I mean, the only place they can go to pretty much is big tech. Of like, who was my dad? Well, here's Facebook. They can sell you his data. So they're going to be gatekeepers of our personal past, of course. And like, let's say that you want to simulate your parents or grandparents based on their data. Of course, there are like three or four companies who are going to be the gatekeepers of doing that. And that's concerning enough. But there's also a second dimension to this, which is the political dimension. The same way that they control or will control your private access to your individual past, they're also going to control our collective access to society's past. And that is, I think, a very dangerous development that nobody seems to be talking about. Yes, it's problematic that these tech giants hold so much power in the present, but imagine the kind of power that they're going to hold in 15, 20 years if things continue on this path. They're basically going to monopolize society's access to its past. The one example I usually bring up when I talk about this is consider the fact that one person, Elon Musk, out of all possible people, essentially owns the entirety of tweets, the entirety of testimonies that constituted the Me Too movement. So when future historians and feminists want to go back and understand like what would happen during Me Too, it's Elon Musk who's going to control who gains access to do that research. And that's just one example out of hundreds or thousands of similar social movements, many, many of which we probably don't even know about today. But the future could be able to actually discern what was important, what happened in these early decades of the web. But we've allocated all of that power to like one or two individuals. And I can't believe that the tech debate is so short-sighted that all we talk about is either, you know, what's blockchain gonna be able to disrupt in the next 5 years, or like how, what are gonna be the next big investments in AI. It's either that, or it's what's AI going to be like in 200 years, and will we live on Mars? And I'm like, hey, look, there are very, very dangerous scenarios on the horizon of like 15, 20 years, which are as if they were from an Orwell novel.
That's right. And these scenarios are not some fantastic sci-fi scenario that may or may not come to pass. You're pointing out forces that are in play right now, trajectories that are set that...
Yeah.
Are going to be, frankly, hard to avoid. I mean, maybe Elon Musk, I can't imagine, maybe at some point the ownership of Twitter/X changes and it's some other billionaire who's the gatekeeper. But we're not on any kind of path right now in our society to make all of this data accessible outside the grasp of a big tech billionaire or some toxic platform out in Silicon Valley. You put this well in a question near the end of the book. You ask, how can platforms be designed for long-term preservation of important historical assets? And I think you had to voice that question because the platforms are right now not built for that.
Yeah. It's really an irony that this consolidation of power and this monopoly of the past, or the access to the past, it's actually not something that big tech wanted in the first place. They don't see themselves as stewards of the past. It's just something that was placed on them, like a necessary consequence of their business models. And of course, since they don't think of themselves as stewards of the past, they do a lot of terrible decisions. I bring up in the book, for instance, YouTube has cleansed out hundreds of thousands of videos documenting war crimes, because to them, to their content moderators, it just looks like basically war propaganda. But what is also war propaganda could also be documentations of war crimes. And there are plenty of journalists and activists trying to preserve such videos. There's the Syrian archive, for instance. But this question of how can they be designed for long-term preservation, in part, that's an internal question for the businesses. Like, people at Facebook, Google, YouTube, etc., need to sit down and ask themselves, like, how can we responsibly steward the past? But I do want to stress, I know that's kind of like a dream scenario.
There,
but
now you're into the sci-fi fantasy section of the conversation. Anyone with influence in those big tech companies is going to sit down and say the word responsible. That's a good one.
Indeed. And that's like to my second point, that the problem is not really the firms. It's not really the people calling the shots and who are having influence over big tech. It's not about the moral qualities of Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk. It's about our design of the economic systems within which these players operate. So the same way that we constantly talk about, like, how to design AI, how to design platforms and design our whatever technologies, I'm like, yes, that's super important, but why don't we ever talk about the design of the systems, the economic systems within which these products are implemented? Like, why does it matter if your AI product is super responsible and just and whatnot, if it's operating within a system which is fundamentally unjust and does not consider any responsibility except for the bottom line of the company implementing the technology? And that's the point that I'm trying to make in the book, that this is bigger than merely implementing a new design feature that solves everything. I really want to show that this question of what do we do with the digital dead, it's intertwined with the biggest questions of our time. It's intertwined with who we want to be as a civilization and a species. And those are very big words. As you referred to this, this first chapter of drawing out the historical context of how we relate to the dead, how we relate to our past, it does define who we are as a civilization. It does define the path that we settle upon into the future.
And at the end of the book, you have an interesting section where you're saying, I'm not actually leading up to a silver bullet solution. Let me just reveal to you, I don't consider myself a Marxist. I don't consider myself a pure free market capitalist. In other words, I'm not trying to lead you to one specific economic system as the answer, which I thought was a thoughtful way to finish the book, to pose these questions and to warn us against being too partisan in a simple solution. It seems like we all have to play a part in the moral reckoning of the kind of society we want to live in, and who knows what shape it's going to take, but it's got to be different from what we have right now.
No, that's very true. And I'm so glad you like that section. When I wrote that final chapter, I knew that what I wanted to say was that this is bigger than any of you think, and it's going to require tools that are not yet invented. But so much of the previous chapters have kind of pointed to the capitalist market, not necessarily the market, the capitalist market, which are two different things. I want to stress that. But the capitalist market is kind of the boogeyman of the book. And when I came to the final chapter, I was like, okay, so there needs to be some kind of answer or conclusion, but I can't finish the book by like, and here's how we abolish capitalism. I talked to my editor about this, and I was like, well, I can't end the book with like a blueprint of how we end capitalism. And she was like, well, if you pull it off, it would make it a very popular book. I was going, well, I'm probably not going to pull that off. But it's true that I am skeptical of state solutions. I'm skeptical of, like, some people suggest that maybe UNESCO or some other UN body or some kind of federation of states could seize control over these archives, of having some kind of like a, you know, humanity's shared archive of the past. And there are some such initiatives. The Internet Archive is one, and there are other really promising digital preservation initiatives, but they never gain access to the really interesting data, of course. I mean, that's all in the hands of big tech still. But the path that we're on leads us towards very dangerous places, and we need to think long and hard about how to avoid it. And we don't have like good answers for it.
I often say that we need both individual and collective solutions. And while we're trying to search for maybe a UNESCO or Internet Archive type solution for our collective digital data, on an individual level, I just want to remind people of something that you write in the book, quote, "If you are at all using the internet, chances are that your digital remains will one day be managed by a for-profit actor." That stood out to me because, for me, on an individual level, that's so depressing to think that by default, my digital assets would be managed by a toxic sludge factory in Northern California. There's got to be another way around this. And so what I've encouraged users to do, again, this is not our collective solution, but for those users who feel motivated to take this on, I always tell people, forget Facebook, get off Google. In other words, get your data on your own local storage device and figure out a backup plan, or maybe print out the stuff that's really important. Give it as physical printouts to your next of kin. In other words, figure out how to get your data off of those platforms and directly into the hands of the people you want to give it to.
No, I think that's a good point. There's a lot one can do. And like, you don't even have to go as far as like, you know, printing it out or putting it on a hard drive, but just a change of like changing the mindset of realizing that like what you put out there, yes, you own it now, but the moment you die, you basically have zero data protection rights. So you may be fine with whatever Facebook or YouTube or X is doing with your data now, but there's going to be a day when you do no longer have the means to protest. And that means that they can basically do whatever they want with that data. If they want to turn it into an AI chatbot and have your descendants pay for access to that chatbot, they're free to do it. And that, I think, should scare people. It amazes me how willingly people throw out their data. Like, I can't remember the exact numbers now, but there are like tens of millions of people who have uploaded their DNA to Ancestry.com. And I'm like, okay, that's fine, because you know that Ancestry is only going to run these particular tests on the data, and that's in their entire business model. Okay, but let's say that you die, Ancestry goes out of business. What's going to happen to all of those DNA data? Well, of course, like as in any insolvency case, they're going to be auctioned out to the highest bidder, which means that there's going to be some company out there who owns the DNA of you and like everyone in your family.
Oh, Elon Musk is definitely taking our DNA to Mars. I mean, we're in the most dystopian timeline, so it has to be something like that.
Yeah, and like imagine if we want to get really dystopian, imagine like a company getting hold of all that data, and in the future you can grow people just from their DNA. And imagine that company like having a business model of selling your loved one back to you. I mean, people already do this with animals. You know that some people clone their animals?
Yes.
So such that they have like the same cat like five times over. And they have like backup cats and dogs in case their dog dies. They can just, you know, have the exact same clone. I can see that being a business model for humans too in 70 years.
And some listeners are going to be thinking of that Black Mirror episode where the husband dies and is brought back as a robotic clone,
mm-hmm.
sold by some sort of AI startup. That looks plausible in a way.
Yeah, the episode is called Be Right Back. And for those of you who haven't seen it, you should really go check it out. It's pretty cool. The name of the husband is Ash. Very witty.
Well, Ash from a crematorium, of course, but yeah. You have to also remember the Evil Dead series.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
All right. You've got to watch the Evil Dead movies starring Bruce Campbell as the protagonist named Ash. So that's in there as well, I'm sure.
Oh, I see. Anyway, so I often bring this episode up to make my case about the business of resurrecting the digital dead. Because in this episode, like, again, everybody talks about the technology, which is, of course, the flashy, cool thing. But the firm that provides the resurrection of Ash is kind of anonymous. It's just a firm that, you know, she gets an invite, the wife, the widow gets an invite from this firm of, like, try out our beta service. And then they're just in the background. And I think this is a really interesting detail because the bot, she originally is just a chat bot, or initially it's only a chat bot, the resurrection of her husband. And then the chat bot suggests, oh, guess what? There's a premium version. You can actually talk to me. And she uploads all of his voice data, so like every recording of his voice. And then it replicates his voice, and then she can talk to him as a live conversation. And then the voice service is like, oh, but there's a third step. There's the humanoid robot. And I think this is an interesting illustration of how the resurrection of the dead is a product, but it also becomes the perfect salesman of that product. It's a product that sells itself by hijacking your most intimate relationship and then taking advantage of that relationship, kind of masquerading as your departed husband, and then the husband going, oh, but like you can't cancel the service. That would be like killing me all over again. And what kind of monster would cancel the service after having had your newly departed husband say that to your face? And I think that kind of illustrates just the stakes of making a business out of resurrecting the dead.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to find out what kind of society that is when business models like that become popular. Anyway, Carl Oman, I enjoyed speaking to you about your book, The Afterlife of Data, What Happens to Your Information When You Die and Why You Should Care. Thanks again for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining 14 minutes of the show. And then Dave Mandel, wearing a sandal, is coming on for his show, It's Complicated, which is a prog rock show. You should listen to it. Then we've got Bad Animals with Amanda and Jim the Poet. And then the eponymous show by the great brother Daniel Blumen. Coming up at 9 p.m. Eastern, going on to midnight Eastern. And that will finish our broadcast Monday. But you can keep listening till Tuesday. It's all good. Thanks very much to Carl Oman from Uppsala University in Sweden for joining me to talk about his book, The Afterlife of Data, What Happens to Your Information When You Die and Why You Should Care. It's published by University of Chicago Press. And as I think you heard, I found it a rich and provocative book full of both history of how we have treated and thought about the dead in the past, and also our future, various scenarios. As Carl was saying, he doesn't know why people are not paying more attention to some of these Orwellian scenarios that are now unfolding. And of course, beyond those scenarios, just to think a little bit about digital archiving, which we had a couple of comments on. There's a really clever quote that Carl got from a digital archivist that I wanted to share with you. Carl, during the book, is pointing out that a printed book can last hundreds of years, but digital archives, as Carl says, require constant care. So there's this categorical difference between print archives and digital archives. And then in the book, Carl quotes a digital preservationist who had a nice phrase, quote, "Digital information lasts forever, or 5 years, whichever comes first." I thought that stated it well. I mean, you never know if the digital bits are going to stay for years and years and years and decades and centuries, or if they're going to be gone tomorrow because of a glitch. You just don't know. So if you want that security, paper, if it's available to you, is generally better. But then, you know, beyond the digital preservation aspect, just this idea of what the big tech companies may do with the data that they're holding on to. I don't know if I have time to get into this. I may have to push this until next week. But there is something that Google put together. Why don't I just go for it? Gosh darn it, here we go. Back in 2018, there was a leaked video from Google. It came out in 2018. Actually, the video had been created within Google in 2016, and it talked about Google's they were just whiteboarding some ideas. Of course, afterwards they said, we would never do something like this, but they had put together this think piece, this idea piece, just for internal usage about how they could use data. It was called the Selfish Ledger. And I did play this on the show years ago, but I haven't played it in a while, so I thought I'd just share an excerpt with you. This is Google's conception for what they would do with people's data throughout their lives and after those people die. So Google has thought exactly about this. And again, this goes way back to 2016, so who knows how far this idea has developed since then. But here's just a quick minute or so excerpt of the Selfish Ledger video.
When we use contemporary technology, a trail of information is created in the form of data. When analyzed, it describes our actions, decisions, preferences, movement, and relationships. This codified version of who we are becomes ever more complex, developing, changing, and deforming based on our actions. In this regard, this ledger of our data may be considered a Lamarckian epigenome, a constantly evolving representation of who we are. In this model, the individual organism is a transient carrier, a survival machine for the gene. User-centered design principles have dominated the world of computing for many decades, but what if we looked at things a little differently? What if the ledger could be given a volition or purpose, rather than simply acting as an historical reference? What if we focused on creating a richer ledger by introducing more sources of information? What if we thought of ourselves not as the owners of this information, but as custodians, transient carriers, or caretakers? Initially, the notion of a goal-oriented ledger may be user-driven. As an organization, Google would be responsible for offering suitable targets for a user's ledger. Whilst the notion of a global good is problematic, topics would likely focus on health or environmental impact to reflect Google's values as an organization.
Okay, so here, Google has this internal video that says the data we're going to treat as almost like a genome that's passed on to successive generations, except we, Google, are going to be the ones who take care of it. And this genome, much like a physical genome, is more than just a record of data. It can be used to encourage certain behaviors, certain lifestyles within the user. And the difference, though, Google says, is that what we suggest to the users will be filtered through Google's own goals. So the data, Google is suggesting that they would use all of the surveillance data, and the video says maybe we could get even more surveillance data, and use that to manipulate the users for our own purposes. And as you'll hear in the next excerpt, this would go on much further than just one generation. Here, the selfish ledger continues.
User data has the capability to survive beyond the limits of our biological selves, in much the same way as genetic code is released and propagated in nature. By considering this data through a Lamarckian lens, the codified experiences within the ledger become an accumulation of behavioral knowledge throughout the life of an individual. By thinking of user data as multi-generational, it becomes possible for emerging users to benefit from the preceding generation's behaviors and decisions. As new users enter an ecosystem, they begin to create their own trail of data. By comparing this emergent ledger with the mass of historical user data, it becomes possible to make increasingly accurate predictions about decisions and future behaviors. As these streams of information are brought together, the effect is multiplied. New patterns become apparent and new predictions become possible. As patterns begin to emerge in the behavioral sequences, they too may be targeted. The ledger could be given a focus, shifting it from a system which not only tracks our behavior, but offers direction towards a desired result. We are at the very beginning of our journey of understanding in the field of user data. By applying our knowledge of epigenetics, inheritance, and memetics to this field, we may be able to make mental leaps in our understanding, which could offer benefits to this generation, to future generations, and the species as a whole.
Oh, Google. They're going to take all of their surveillance data on us and add more and turn it into, as they call it, multi-generational data, so that our data, surveillance data, gets added to the dossier of our kids and grandkids. And then that's going to all pass through Google's own corporate priorities, which we know are growth at any cost and a total lack of ethics, so that they can, in Google's words, benefit the species as a whole. I mean, just the blind arrogance is just staggering in just those couple of minutes of excerpts that I just played for you. And that was 8 years ago. That was 2016. Who knows where Google has advanced in their goals and their plans for turning their surveillance data on us into a multi-generational manipulation machine. So this is all to say what Carl Oman is bringing up in this book, the afterlife of data, is real. This is not, as I said in the interview, it's not a sci-fi notional future this might happen. Big tech is working on this right now to surveil you, your family, your friends, your community, and to turn that into a monetizable baseline of manipulation that could go on for generations. I'm not exactly sure what our next step is, but I do have some advice for you, which I'm going to give to you in a moment. I'm out of time. What can I tell you? I can tell you that you are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. And here's my advice I'll close the show with. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, get off Google. Oh, and one other little point of advice before Dave Mantel comes in. It's a song by Lulu Lewis called Destroy All Data. Have a great week, everybody.
Destroy all data. Futurist.
And they're off. Welcome to another exciting installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. We're here every Monday evening between the hours of 7 and 8 for 1 hour. We, meaning me and my imaginary friend. I'm Dave Mandel, your host for this program, and thanks very much for joining us this week. I'm going to start tonight's show with some music from Japan. This is going to be a group called Kenzo, or Kenso, K-E-N-S-O, and it's a track from their third album, appropriately entitled Kenzo numeral 3, Roman numeral 3, I should say. And it's from 1985. Very proggy, very good. This is Kenzo. We'll be right back. and music there from the Japanese group Kenso, K-E-N-S-O, sort of Yellow Magic Orchestra meets ELP, kind of, right? Like a Japanese 80s electronic thing crossed with some kind of Baroque, post-Baroque Prague. I like it. A track that I managed to find the English language translation of the track title. I'm very proud of that. Power of the Glory. The track titles are in Japanese on the CD, but I dug up that translation. Don't ask me how. Power of the Glory. Is it a reference to the Gentle Giant album of almost the same title? We may never know. 1985 recording from the group Kenso. And before I forget, I want to mention something very important, a station-related announcement. Our new schedule, we have two schedule periods here at FMU, one long one, the fall-winter schedule, and one much, much shorter one, which is the summer schedule. We are approaching the end of the summer schedule right now, and our fall-winter schedule starts promptly next Monday morning at 6 a.m., I guess, first thing next Monday, September 9th. 2024, and among other things, I guess the most important thing for me to tell you is that I will remain in this slot. So, Nick, for at least another 9 months, you got me here continuing to play the hits for you every Monday evening at 7. I'm very happy that I'll still be in this slot. And look, go to our website, wfmu.org, for all the details about the new schedule. The usual situation, some shows are taking a break, some new people are joining, some people are moving to different places on the schedule. We like to keep you guessing and confused. So go to the website. One thing that I'm sad about, but I'm sure it was their decision. Bad Animals, the show that has been following me, is taking this season off, and I'm sorry they are, but I hope they'll be back. I certainly hope they'll be back next summer. But give them a rousing send off tonight, please, for their before their several months long break. In the 8 p.m. slot right after this show will be DJ Stashu. She took the last season, took this summer season off, and she's going to be back on the schedule. So she will be following me Mondays at 8 p.m. and following Stashu at 9 as usual. Will be Daniel Blumen. He remains in the 9 to midnight slot Monday evenings. Again, go to our website, check out all the exciting details there. All right, I'm going to play, what am I going to play? I know. We're going to go to Brazil now. Going to head down sort of southwest or southeast, I guess, depending on which way you fly from.